For those of you who don't know me, my name's Les Rowe, and I'm the acting president of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victoria. This is our first speech for the year. It's our first evening for the year, and we knew we were going to get a bumper crowd because two things. One, we've got Sally Totman speaking to us, and she was a great hit last year. And the second thing is that the issues she will be addressing are of such fundamental importance and such pivotal importance to so many other things that can go wrong. Sally Totman is a senior lecturer in Middle Eastern Studies at La Trobe University. Deakin University? There you go, bad start to the year. It's not the worst thing I did. I sent something out recently wishing everybody a Happy New Year in the year of the water buffalo, wherein, of course, it wasn't. It was... So, somebody's getting back at me. Yes, Sally is a senior lecturer in Middle Eastern Affairs at Deakin University, and she's had extensive experience working at the university, working in as a consultant, as a commentator on Middle Eastern affairs. Now, many of you will remember it's just over a year ago that an unnamed fruit vendor immolated in Tunisia, setting off a whole series of events which have led to what could only be called a bit of a mess. In the past, it used to be thought, particularly in certain circles in Washington, that all you had to do was get rid of the dictators in the Middle East, democracy would flow, and everything would be happy. Well, we've seen that getting rid of dictators, getting rid of authoritarian rule, doesn't automatically and easily lead to democracy, which is a fragile flower which takes time to develop. And so for that reason, I inserted into the title of the address the quote from St. Teresa of Avila, "More tears are shed over answered prayers than over unanswered ones." So, Sally, Arab Spring, where to now? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Les. Can you hear me?
Yep.
For the invitation. For those of you that were here last year, you'll know that my crystal ball doesn't work. And so when I saw the topic of where to now, I was like, uh-oh, because things are very, very fluid right across the region. And they do change, I suppose, on a daily basis. And there are so many variables at play that, you know, my predictions generally never work out. So what I thought I would do tonight is to look, I guess, more generally about the issues that are facing the region, and then try to put the recent events into a context that will actually help us to interpret and frame our understanding of what's to come, whatever that might be. And I won't try and predict too much, but I am, I guess, trying to tell you what the challenges are that they're going to face regardless of what happens. So what I thought I'd do is borrow something from one of my colleagues, Henry Precht, who actually was a State Department advisor to Carter during the Iranian Revolution. And he talks about something called the 7 F words, which are a guide to the Middle East, or a guide to understanding the Middle East. You know, and F words are generally appropriate when it comes to the Middle East. So they are fecund football, fully independent, fiscal, faith, freedom, and the F word. So I guess I want to explain what I mean by that. So the first one, fecund, it's a very fertile region. In the early 60s, the population of Egypt was around 23 million. It's now just over 82 million. It's more than tripled in that 40-year period, or 50-year period. The populations of the cities of Cairo and Alexandria have also tripled. So there's a huge population pressure that we can sort of hardly imagine, I don't think, living in Australia where our population is so sort of small. Now, part of that is because over sort of this period, family planning hasn't received enough or any sort of effective emphasis. And this is a problem not just in Egypt, but right across the region. In fact, all of the Arab countries face this population explosion. Somebody's got their phone on. The only, I guess, country in the region that doesn't have this issue is Iran, and it's not an Arab country. And the reason for that is that they've had a strong anti-birth sort of program that replaced their very strong pro-birth program that they had during the Iraq War. And one of the reasons that they actually were able to do this, a bit like China with the one-child policy, was that the Ayatollah basically instigated the policy saying we can't afford a large population, we can't support the population we've got, we need to limit that for the future long-term benefit of the country. And having had a strong leader sort of implement this policy, it's actually paying off. You know, their population growth isn't nearly as rapid or extreme as the Arab world. But the, I guess, what I would describe as regional autocrats within the Arab world haven't had that sort of power, I suppose, to be able to curb what is tradition and perhaps, I guess, ignorance on part of the population. They feel that they need a big family to be able to support them in their old age, and so they must have lots of children, which actually stresses the economy more in the short term. Now, a lot of people have said, well, they've got such a large population and huge unemployment, and that's why there's, you know, the revolution. And I'm certainly not saying that they would have less rebellions, but they would certainly have fewer stone throwers, you know, within these revolutions, and fewer unemployed stone throwers at that. So in addition to providing, I guess, for such a large and fast-growing population, it's increasingly difficult for the governments to actually sustain what they have, but also improve the lifestyle. And this relates to the other points that I'm going to follow through. The next one is football, which might sound a bit strange, but it's a big part of understanding the Middle East, of understanding nationalism, of understanding the people. In 2009, Egyptian fans rioted after Algeria beat them in the World Cup qualifying match. There were deaths. And not only that, but fans from both sides actually rioted in four other countries across the region. And in Libya and in Syria, they were allowed to riot because of this football game that went awry, both sides. And it went further than that. Egypt actually recalled their ambassador to Algiers because of this sort of diplomatic incident over the Egyptians believe that the Algerians cheated. You know, so rebellion isn't just about political change. You know, this is something that is, I guess, part of the population, this sort of nationalism, this way of expressing yourself and expressing that sort of nationalist raw emotion. It, you know, had nothing to do with Mubarak speechifying or anything like that. There was nothing formal about it. It was sort of, instantaneous, a bit like what we've seen in the Arab Spring. That same sort of people came onto the street, more people came onto the street, and so it grew from there. And this is something that we see right across the region, and not just in the Arab Spring, but all the time. You know, in Iraq, you know, there's protests, you know, against, you know, the American occupation. We saw that right through the last 10-year period. In Iran, there's constant protests. You know, the elections were rigged, the elections weren't rigged. You know, there's protests against all sorts of things. And this is kind of, I guess, the raised fist that we tend to associate with the Arab world. But it's not just the Arab world. You know, we see it in Turkey, we see it in Iran, we see it in Israel too. And the Arab Spring, which is, I guess, what I'm meant to be talking about, did spread to other parts of the region. You know, we've had protests in Iran, we've had protests in Israel, you know, sort of Jewish protests against the cost of housing, all sorts of things that have spread on from that. So protesting is something that, I guess, not just relates to football, but is part of, I suppose, something we don't do in Australia as a rule. Julia Gillard would certainly freak out if she had all those kinds of protests that we see on a regular basis. Well, she freaks out quite easily. All right, so fully independent. Now, this is something that we perhaps need to remind ourselves, is that these protests aren't just asking for a change of government. They're not just saying, let's overthrow Mubarak or Gaddafi and change government. They're actually asking for independence from the West as well, independence from foreign intervention, you know, total nationalistic independence. You know, and this is one of the principal demands of the Iranian Revolution, and it's the one that the current protesters in the Arab world are also demanding. Now, they're not sort of, they haven't gone as far as to carry, you know, death to America signs like the Iranians did, but I would caution that that perhaps, you know, is still to come. You know, they're very unimpressed, I suppose, with the way that they view, you know, West's interaction with these countries or with these protests. And I think that the successor regimes that emerge out of this, so the ones that are coming from in Tunisia and in Egypt, and they're not willing to commit their fortunes to a power that they see as imperialist. They're not willing to sign on for the things that we would like them to sign on for. Democracy, yes, but they want independence more than that. They don't necessarily want a Western democracy as much as they want to be free from interference and from the hypocrisy that they see us promoting in those countries. And if we look at the trends in the recent Tunisian elections or Egyptian elections, we can see this. They're voting for parties that are anti-West, that are anti-foreign intervention. The Muslim Brotherhood, you know, is pro-Egyptian, but not necessarily pro-democracy, not necessarily pro-America or pro, you know, Europe. And I'll come back to that a bit more too. Fiscal. All right. So this is, I guess, what all countries are experiencing at the moment with the economic crisis. But the Middle East has been experiencing economic and financial problems for quite some time. They have a huge surplus labour force in all of the countries across the region. And as a result, the young population in particular can't generate sort of a decent life for themselves. There are no jobs. You can't get housing, there are no apartments, so you can't get married. So there's all these sort of issues, and they have nowhere to turn but to the government for help. And up until very recently, and in fact, even sort of, I guess, today, the governments are refusing to sort of assist with this because they can't. They can't create jobs out of nothing. They can't create apartments and housing out of nothing, particularly when the governments are in debt. And, you know, the autocrats have been sort of, I guess, schooled by the IMF that, you know, you can't just keep bailing out your country, which is sensible. You can't. You know, Greece has learnt that the hard way. So the successor regimes that we're going to see coming about after these sort of revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, they've still got these problems. You know, you can't just magic up some housing or magic up some jobs because you've been voted in. It doesn't work like that. And so there are no easy fixes for the economy. So this is something that we need to keep in mind when we're, you know, hoping for a quick fix or democracy to bring the answers. And when we look at Europe and we think about the financial debt crisis that everyone's in and how awful that is, it's 10 times worse in the Middle East, and it has been for the last 30 years. So the average Egyptian or the average Tunisian is very, very poor indeed, and the outlook is very, very grim. Okay, five, faith. And this is something that we kind of think, well, you know, everyone's Muslim, but that's not quite the same. And even what we would deem as Muslims don't describe, like, see other Muslims are quite the same way. A prime example of this, I guess, tough one would be Bahrain, where the ruling regime is refusing to recognise reality. There's a lot of R's in that. But it's, you know, a potent force right across the region. In Iran, it's a way of uniting the people. You know, their faith, their system, their theocracy unites people. But in a lot of the countries of the Middle East, they've used a religion as a way of, I guess, keeping the people under control in many respects. So in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood had been banned from, you know, elections previously under Mubarak, but now people are voting for them. But the Coptic Christians are feeling persecuted. They're 10% of the population, and they are feeling, you know, the pinch of that. In Syria, the Alawites, the ruling, you know, minority, are afraid of what would happen should, you know, the majority Sunnis gain control. Would there be paybacks like there was in Iraq after the fall of Saddam? So religion in the Middle East isn't separate from political life. Islam doesn't separate mosque and state. And so this is something that we need to keep in mind. We can't expect a secular government to come with democracy. The democracy will most likely look a bit more like Iran, you know, that it will be intertwined with the political life. And so democracy and secularity are something that we probably won't expect to see. Freedom. And this is, I guess, what we think everyone's protesting for. And for centuries, I guess, the ruling elites have basically said, well, you know, they can't handle freedom. In fact, Mubarak is quoted as saying they're not ready for democracy. But anyone in the Middle East, any of the leaders, would say that. And freedom is, I suppose, what the people are after, freedom of expression, freedom to vote, you know, freedom to make life choices. But the elite's opposition to freedom shouldn't be underestimated. You know, the elite is still very much in power in all of these countries, even where the leader has been toppled. And I'll come back to that also. Okay, so the last one, very quickly. Well, this is finally as in sort of what the F does Washington understand or care about the realities of the Middle East. And this is the feeling that the average Middle Eastern citizen has about the West and about Washington and about everything outside of their own country. And it's a big one. They don't think that the West is a force for good. They don't think foreign intervention is a good thing. The West, and mostly I'm talking about the United States, but I'm also talking about Europe and even Australia, you know, with our interventions in Iraq, for instance. We're not seen as a force for good. We're viewed with suspicion at best. We're seen as being hypocritical, self-serving, and corrupt. And we've been seen as supporting these sort of despotic regimes in the region, particularly Mubarak, but also the Saudis. Our relationship sort of with the Saudis has perhaps coloured our judgment when it came to what was happening in Bahrain. And certainly it coloured, you know, the response of Europe and the United States when it came to Egypt. And if I wanted to throw in Israel, you know, this is where that also comes in. So I wanted to, I guess, use that as a guide to what I'm going to say, because a lot of what I say relates back to these sort of fundamental, I guess, F framework things. And it gives, I guess, a way of understanding why the protesters perhaps are protesting and don't have the view that we have of what's going on in their own countries. Does that make sense? Am I talking too fast?
No.
Good? All right. So, uprisings. And I want to, I guess, look, having looked at the Fs, the sort of the context between the hype of, you know, the Arab world is, you know, changed completely, you know, the old regimes have gone and it's all a brave new world, against the actual results of what we've seen in the last 12 months, or a bit longer. So what has, I guess, really happened, and are we seeing real change, or are we seeing a little bit of change with a lot more hype wrapped around it? And I pulled this map off the internet, essentially because I have no skills in graphic design. But it says that, you know, if you look at sort of the Arab world, there's something happened right across it. The navy blue in Egypt and Tunisia is saying that there's been a revolution. Well, no, not quite. Tunisia wasn't really a revolution. Yes, it sort of sparked the flame off, but no one realised what was happening until it sort of happened. Ben Ali resigned. He fled. He went to Saudi Arabia. 223 people were killed in sort of the ensuing violence, but it wasn't really protests like the sides that we saw in Egypt or anything even remotely like that. It was sort of all over very, very quickly in Tunisia. They've settled down. They had elections. They're starting to look at their constitution. They are making changes, but perhaps not a revolution more than just an uprising where the government sort of, you know, gave up. In Egypt, though, yes, it was definitely a revolution. There was the overthrow of Mubarak. He's now on trial for killing protesters. Statistics say there's about 850 people who were killed sort of in this sort of period. I don't know if that number's correct or not. It's a UN figure. Who knows with them? They've held elections, but they've held elections where the Muslim Brotherhood now holds a majority of power, which means it's a very different kind of democracy to the perhaps one that we would like to envisage. You know, this is very similar if you think back to the Palestinian elections in 2006 where the wrong party got in, and so we've had to deal with that sort of since. Washington has recently threatened to stop the $1.3 billion of aid that Egypt receives every year from them. You know, this will plunge Egypt into crisis beyond belief because that's what they rely on. You know, that's their second biggest source of income is foreign aid. After tourism, which has also been plunged into crisis because nobody wants to go and visit the pyramids while people are protesting. Libya, according to my map, there's a civil war going on there. Perhaps. Gaddafi was overthrown. The National Transitional Council is now in charge. And what's interesting about the NTC is that it's actually made up of former Gaddafi elites. You know, they swap sides early, the, sort of his former generals and people who were actually, many of them, who were involved in the revolution in 1969 with him that overthrew the king, are now in charge. They're very old but, you know, still quite ambitious. And they don't see democracy as being something that they're aiming towards. They haven't scheduled elections. They haven't come up with anything other than a way of accessing the money that was frozen in European accounts. And that's about as far as they've got. And the country, you know, in terms of sort of, I guess, progress, the average Libyan is doing worse than they were under Gaddafi. Yes, they have freedom to do all sorts of things, but there's nothing really to do because they're not allowed to vote still. You know, and there is killings going on. There was, I think, 40 people killed yesterday in sort of, I guess, pro-Gaddafi clashes with National Transitional Council troops. So I wouldn't call it a civil war just yet, but 30,000 people have died in Libya as a result of this violence. So a lot has happened, but where's the result? And the NTC, in a report last week, are now accused of abusing prisoners in jail, very much like Gaddafi was doing, you know, this time last year. So yes, there's been change, but it's still the same kind of people. It's just that, you know, my handsome dictator is gone. For those of you who were here last time, I've got a crush on Gaddafi, or I did before he died. So, I should admit that. So, Yemen, well, it's saying here that they have sustained civil disorder and there's been some, you know, sort of concessions made by the government. Well, yes, the president has sought medical treatment in the US and has ended his 33-year rule. He's left some of his cronies in charge back home while he goes off for treatment. 1,900 people have been killed. They've made very little progress in terms of any kind of constitutional changes, although they have promised elections, but they haven't gone any further into saying how free and fair they might be. More interestingly, though, the US seems to be making a practice of, you know, using their drones to have targeted killings of al-Qaeda militants on a daily basis in Yemen. And so this is, I suppose, you know, helping with the ongoing war on terror, which seems to have faded into the background recently. But again, it's a country that doesn't have any sort of benefits for the average Yemeni. You know, the average Yemeni is very poor indeed, and increasingly, I suppose, marginalised by what's going on. Now, Bahrain's an interesting one. It doesn't actually get a colour in my map, perhaps because it's so small and the person who did the map has the same skills I have. But it's a very interesting, I guess, anomaly in the uprisings, because the GCC, or the Gulf Cooperation Council, or more specifically Saudi Arabia, sent their tanks over to help support the government quash the uprisings there. So, you know, some uprisings are supported by, you know, the other member states. Now, the Saudis obviously have a vested interest in what goes on across the bridge in Bahrain, because that's where, you know, all sorts of people go for gambling and drinking and whatever else. It's sort of the Las Vegas of the Middle East. But it's because it's a monarchy. It's different to the dictatorships that we've seen fall in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and what's going on in Syria. It's a monarchy. It has that kind of legitimacy. But it also has implications for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is also a corrupt monarchy that oppresses its people. And so Bahrain, if that fell, it perhaps would start a domino of monarchies falling. And so that's perhaps why the Saudis intervened more than anything else. But 60 people were killed. They're still, you know, putting down protests on a daily basis. And they've made very few concessions to their population. Syria. According to my map, it's sort of the same as Yemen. There's daily violence and civilian deaths. So far, about 5,500 people have died as a result, and it's rising daily. You know, it's rising while I'm giving this talk right now. People are being shot for protesting. The observer mission that was set up by the Arab League has been cancelled because it was too dangerous for them. Now, what does that say, about the Arab League, but also about what's going on in Syria? If it's too dangerous for the people who are meant to be bringing about, you know, peace, then surely, you know, it's descended into more than sort of a disaster. That said, Bashar's still hanging on. He's still in power. And he doesn't look like he's going to be, you know, doing a Mubarak anytime soon and stepping down to face charges. Looking at the other countries, you know, really nothing else has happened. There's been very superficial political changes in countries like Algeria, Jordan, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Morocco, Western Sahara. You know, in Algeria, they just got rid of their state of emergency laws. That was basically the only thing that they've done. That's sort of really, you know, not much of a concession for people who had, you know, a 15-year civil war previously. In Jordan, the king dismissed the government and some of the ministers and reappointed, you know, sort of their relatives and business as usual. You know, and the same goes for the other countries. Saudi Arabia said, well, we'll allow women to vote in local elections. How about that? So very small changes, enough though to get a colour on the map. So, oh, and Sudan, not to forget Sudan. Well, the president there has said that he won't seek re-election in 2015. So that was his concession. I'll just be in power for another 3 years and then I won't run again. So essentially, I mean, in terms of hype, yes, we've had change. You know, three leaders have gone. But other than that, that's about it. Because in all those countries, in Tunisia, in Egypt and in Libya, it's the elites are still in control. The people really haven't had much of a voice. And in Egypt, yes, they voted, but they could only vote from a select few. And yes, the Muslim Brotherhood were part of that select few, but they have no experience. That's the other thing that's lacking in these countries is political experience. So it's all fine to, you know, get into power, but then what do? You know, the mechanisms of bureaucracy are very, very weak in these countries. So to kind of, how much time have I got? I'm going okay?
You're fine.
I forgot to bring a watch.
There's a clock up there.
Oh, there is too, and I can't see it because I'm blind.
All right. I'll give you a ding.
You give me a ding, all right. So what I thought I would do is look at perhaps the responses to the uprisings from our perspective and try and couch it in terms of how Middle Easterners see those responses. And that's actually, I guess, within that framework of how they see us in terms of the Fs. So in Tunisia, we didn't have a response because it all happened before we noticed. Ben Ali had fled and we went, wow, okay, well, there's something happening in Tunisia, that's good. So there's not much to say there, really. We were completely taken unawares of what happened. But what I'd like to do is focus on, I guess, the main countries of this, so Egypt and Libya and Syria, because we had very different responses in terms of diplomatic efforts, in terms of military intervention, in terms of financial measures. And the responses were different by the West, by the United States and Europe and NATO, but also by the leaders themselves. And this, I guess, has lessons for where to next for people like Bashar al-Assad or even, you know, leaders that are sort of on the brink, you know, in Bahrain. So in Egypt, everybody sat back and waited to see what was happening. The US sat back and kind of didn't side with Mubarak. They didn't side with the people. You know, Obama was very, very quiet about it. He was, I think, still talking about healthcare at the time. But it was very, very quiet. They waited to see which way the wind was blowing before they committed themselves. Mubarak also kind of waited to see whether the protests would keep going, whether the military would start shooting the protesters. He was kind of trying to feel what the US was doing. They were waiting for him. Everyone sort of sat back for quite some time. But eventually, the military basically decided. The military is still in control in Egypt. And they went, well, you know, the US won't like it if we start shooting protesters and arresting people and cracking down on them, because that's where we get all our money from. The $1.3 billion goes almost entirely to support the military and its apparatus. And so they didn't want to, I guess, offend their biggest backer, so they did nothing, which left Mubarak out on a limb. So he stepped down to be arrested. He didn't flee. He sort of thought he would go, you know, to his beachside lodge and wait it out. So he was arrested, and now he's on trial. Well, there's a lesson in that for Gaddafi, who's up next. You know, and I guess why? Why did it turn out that way? Well, Mubarak was a good friend of the United States. He'd kept a peace treaty with Israel for 30 years. He kept the border between Gaza and Egypt locked. He was basically complicit, I suppose, in the lockdown of Gaza. And he was rewarded for that friendship with Israel and the United States through the aid. And up until the revolution, Egypt was the second largest recipient of US untied aid. And it was, I guess, a partner for peace, if you want to call it that. And being reliant on US military aid, so the circle went around. But when he fell, he fell big time. So Gaddafi looked across and saw what happened in Egypt and thought, well, I'm not going to step down and get arrested and put on trial. That would suck. I'm not going to kind of let the military, you know, let the protesters go wild until I'm overthrown. What I'll do is I'll crack down on them, you know, which is probably what he would have done anyway, because he was fairly heavy-fisted at the best of times, even when he was being sweet and eccentric. But the US response was very different. And so was, I suppose, the UN and the NATO response. The UN sanctioned a NATO-led military intervention, which we all know to protect the citizens, and it exceeded the mandate, I think, that the UN had set out. It, rather than just sort of protecting people from Gaddafi's forces, it took to proactively bombing Gaddafi strongholds until basically Gaddafi died. And then they stopped and pulled out. Well, I guess the question is why the different approach? Well, Gaddafi was an old enemy. You know, he's very easy target to, I guess, demonise. You know, he was eccentric, he was violent, he was quite nuts, really. And, you know, so it was an easy option. The other thing, too, is that Libya has a small population. It's all along the coast. It's a very easy to have an air sort of mission without putting boots on the ground, which everyone's against after Iraq. But the thing that relates, I guess, to my seven Fs is that it has oil. And that's a big difference. Egypt didn't have any oil. And this relates to, I guess, point seven about what does the US know about the Middle East? Well, it knows it has oil. And, you know, if I was going to be, I guess, the average Libyan or perhaps even the average Syrian right now, you know, when they look at the difference about why there wasn't foreign intervention in Syria, the difference is oil. Syria doesn't have any oil. And so it's that hypocrisy that perhaps leads us back to that idea of, you know, freedom of foreign influence and things like that. And I'll probably come back to that again in question time, I imagine. So Syria, a very different response yet again, but, you know, a total lack of European or US interest, really. You know, the State Department keeps strongly condemning the violence in Syria. Well, that's very nice, but, you know, 5,500 people have died. You know, strongly condemning it doesn't perhaps seem enough when they'd actually intervened in Libya. The Arab League sent off the observer mission to kind of try and bring about peace, but they had to cancel that because it was too dangerous. So why the difference? Well, from, I guess, the Bashar al-Assad's point of view, it's an obvious thing. You know, I look at Ben Ali or Mubarak, or do I look at Gaddafi, you know? Do I step down and flee and live in exile? Do I step down, be arrested for war crimes and charged and sent to jail? Or do I fight it out and hope for the best like Gaddafi? Well, I don't know about you, but I know what I would choose if I was him. You know, I'd do exactly what he's doing. It makes perfect sense, and he's not been given any kind of out. There's been no kind of diplomatic, you know, concessions given to him. The US response? Well, Syria's been linked to Iran, they've been linked to Hezbollah, they've been linked to Hamas, they're anti-the US, you know, presence in Iraq. They're probably an enemy, not quite like Gaddafi, but certainly no supporter of the US. But perhaps more importantly for Syria is timing. You know, in between what happened to Gaddafi back in August and now, it seems that Europe has collapsed. The world economy has taken centre stage, and we're not really worried about, you know, Middle Eastern humanitarian concerns when we have to worry about the European debt crisis or the European cruise liner that's on its side. You know, sort of news moves on very quickly, and you know, killing of Syrians every day is, you know, a bit boring now because, well, we've been doing that for a year. If I was going to be hypocritical, I would say that there's no oil. You know, Syria doesn't have any oil reserves that we would like to tap right now. And, you know, so let's just leave things in the hands of the Arab League because they'll be able to handle it. I probably shouldn't get started on the Arab League, which is busy rebranding itself as a bastion of democracy. And its curious doings, I suppose, raise more questions than they answer. And this is a group that is really never achieved anything other than bickering amongst themselves at meetings. They're incredibly dysfunctional. And their first response is to expel people from the Arab League if they don't do what they're told. So negotiation doesn't work. So Syria has now been expelled from the Arab League. So not a big surprise they don't want the Arab League monitoring what they're doing. So I guess the whole point of this thing was, where to now? And I guess what I've been trying to do is to explain where we're at, and perhaps what the future holds. And I think that the big thing is that regardless of who is in power, irrespective of, you know, whether Bashar stays or goes, or whether the Muslim Brotherhood get in and we have an Islamist government in Egypt, or anything else, there are some really big issues facing the region, and it's going to take a really, really long time to sort out. And using Egypt as a case study, I thought I'd look at some of those things in the context of the S that I looked at earlier. So Egypt, it has a large population. It has high growth rate and a youth bulge. It has a population, as I said before, of over 82 million. 33% of their population is under 14 years of age. A third of their population is under the age of 14. So this is something that's a problem now, but it's going to be a problem for the next 60 years, particularly if the growth rate keeps up as it is. So the median age in Egypt is 24, which is also kind of like the average age of the protesters in Egypt, amazingly enough. The population growth rate is 2%. So if we keep adding 2% each year to 82 million, I can't do the math on that, but it's getting pretty huge. All right, so more... Sorry? Oh, no, can you do the maths on that?
Over a million.
Yeah, wow. I mean, and that, you know, puts a strain on the healthcare system, on the education system, housing, you name it, it's strained. And it's pretty bad already. Don't get sick in Egypt, trust me. Poverty, that's a big one. Now, the statistics, and these are government statistics, so we'll take them with a government grain of salt, but they say that more than 20% of Egyptians live below the poverty line. Now, that's 17 million people live below the poverty line in Egypt. Now, we have a population of 21.7 million in Australia, so that's like pretty much all of us living below the poverty line. You know, how do you fix that? You know, where do you get the money from to fix that? How do you even begin to think about fixing it? Literacy. That's a huge one. 71% of the population is literate, which means that there are 24 million Egyptians over the age of 15 who can't read. That's more than the population of Australia. How do you fix that? How do you provide jobs for those people? How do you provide, you know, an education or a future? The GDP per capita is $6,500. You know, we're talking a very, very poor country indeed. The big one that we worry about in Australia is unemployment. Does anyone want to hazard a guess at the unemployment rate in Egypt? Yeah, 25% is the official rate. So that means that one in four people who want to work don't. And there's many more that are underemployed. The Egyptian government is amazing at providing jobs for people to stamp bits of paper, you know, and get paid minimum wage for it. If you've ever been to Egypt, you know what I'm talking about. Corruption is the other thing that's rife. There's a lack of functioning bureaucracy, as I said, but also there's a huge reliance on government subsidies for a lot of things that happen. So bread, for instance, food. So we've seen riots, you know, because of, you know, price of grain, price of bread. We've seen queues for basic needs. But the corruption is huge, and it's still there. Mubarak's gone, but all his cronies are still, you know, present. They're still living in their mansions, and, you know, if you want something done, it's, you know, who you know, not what you know. There's a lack of private enterprise in these countries and a lack of opportunity for small business, and everything is pretty much owned by the government, and it's very hard to, you sort of, I guess, establish yourself in any kind of, you know, business. If you want to open a business, the average time that it takes to sort of get through the paperwork is about 3 years. So, you know, why would you bother? There's also a lack of market diversity in many of these countries, but in Egypt in particular, their largest area is textiles, followed by tourism, followed by foreign aid. Well, textiles is being affected by the European crisis. You know, Egyptian cotton is not as highly in demand as it was. Tourism. Anyone thinking of going to Egypt for a holiday? No. And that's, you know, the occupancy rate of hotels at the moment is less than 20%. You know, and it's not just hotels, it's restaurants, it's the people that, you know, carry your bags and ask for bakshish every 5 seconds. You know, it's affecting absolutely everybody. Foreign aid. you know, that's what they rely on to keep the economy going. That's what the military's relied on. If that disappears and it's drying up much more rapidly than they anticipated, it'll be plunged further and further into sort of the black hole. So I guess outlining just what's happening in Egypt, that goes right across the region. And many of these countries are worse off than Egypt in many respects. You know, Sudan has natural resources, but because of the ongoing, you know, conflicts there, you know, no one can access them properly. You know, in Libya, you know, the country was bombed so badly by NATO that they have no infrastructure. The main road, and there's only really one... the main road, you know, you can't get from one side to the other easily. And it's still dangerous. That's the other thing. It's a bit like Iraq. You know, there's you can't send your child to school because there are no schools open. You can't go to the hospital because they've been bombed and they have no medical supplies anyway. You know, it's very, very dire in all of these countries. And there are no easy fixes to these problems. So I guess in summary, because I've been given the hurry up, the uprisings have removed many of the leaders, well, at least three, but the seven Fs still remain, and all these sort of associated issues with those. And I think the recent elections that we've seen give us this illusion that there's freedom, but the average Egyptian is worse off today than they were under Mubarak. The lack of tourism, the lack of foreign aid, it's impacting the economy, plus a European debt crisis. You know, we're worried about the poor Germans and the Greeks and the Portuguese, but it's also flowing on to the Middle East. So the future is bleak. Where to now? The future is bleak. The new leaders lack experience, they lack the resources to bring about change quickly, and the populations in Tunisia and Egypt are already being, I guess, or showing their disenchantment with the new leadership. And so, yeah, I'll end on a really sad note to say that, you know, it's all downhill from here.
Well, thanks very much, Sally. You're not ending there, of course. We've got you for another half hour. Well, I suppose now, after Sally's talk, if any of you who are approached by somebody saying, "What the seven Fs is going on in the Middle East?" you'll have a good framework with which to respond. We've got half an hour for questions. 28 minutes of questions. Would you please give your name and any affiliation you may have? Yep.
Bob Foster. Jan and I are unaffiliated, but we did live 5 years in Muslim countries. One statistic I remember, when we lived in Dover, I looked up the GDP per capita in Qatar. Mm-hmm. It was 150% that of the GDP per capita in Australia, a rich country. But in Australia, they had 1.8 live births to a woman. In Qatar, it is 6.4. There has to be a reason for that. You never really mention religion. My hypothesis, I don't know, but my hypothesis is the population problem is more likely to be religious than economic. Is that possibly so?
Yes and no. typical answer. Qatar is a very... an anomalous country, like some of the Gulf states. The population statistics or the GDP statistics are because it's a very, very rich country, but that wealth isn't actually trickled down to the people necessarily. They do have large families. It's traditional, perhaps, or cultural, more than religious. There's certainly no religious kind of edicts about how many children to have or anything like that, but if you can afford to have children, well, why wouldn't you? And so in Qatar, yes, they do. In Egypt, they tend to have them as an insurance policy. You know, there is no old age pension, so if you live to 80 and you stop working at 60, you know, or 70, you need that kind of support The other thing too is that life expectancy in these countries, you know, most of your children, well, today will make it through to adulthood, but in previous generations they wouldn't. You might have six children and three would make it to adulthood. And so you would have extras, you would have spares, which sounds really kind of dodgy, but it's sort of, that's been the, I guess, traditional practice, and so it's continued on. So there's a couple of, I guess, variables within that, but they do have much larger families. You know, one of the things that Israel is finding is that, you know, the Orthodox Jews have large families, but the, you know, sort of more secular Israelis have, you know, two children. They're very much like Australia. But the Palestinian families are having six and seven and eight, and so the population balance in the occupied territories is changing. And so that's one of the debates that's going on in Israel at the moment, is maybe we should encourage people to have more children to keep our population, you know, competitive with our enemy's population. So there's a lot of factors within that. Does that kind of answer?
Well, I was...
Yes, indeed. Sorry, it was an excellent answer.
Oh. I'm confused now, too.
Zara.
Zara Kingston, from the NYA. You talked of the US, the lack of US interest in Syria, because it didn't have oil. But at the same time, you, when you were talking about Libya, you talked of how the UN had gone too far with this too keen. So my question is, as far as Syria goes, where is the UN? And why are you saying that it's the US that's not showing an interest? Because in fact the US didn't really, it wasn't the lead actor in Libya. Wasn't it more of the French and the British? So why are you suddenly bringing the US in?
Okay. All right. So you're right. In Libya, it was very much, I guess, the French and the Europeans who were driving that and pushing the UN in terms of sort of an intervention. But they couldn't have done an intervention without the United States. You know, they were using their planes, they were using their missiles. You know, so there's that element to it. The UN has, you know, condemned what's going on in Syria very strongly, but the UN has no power without its member states. And the Europeans are busy, you know, with their own crisis. Sarkozy's facing an election soon. There's a debt crisis there, you know, being downgraded to whatever rating it is. AA? It doesn't really matter. But the US probably, you know, in terms of, I guess, relationship with Syria, has been very, I guess, absent from any kind of UN debate or interaction. They did have a lot more in Libya.
What about the Russians? Why, you know?
Well, the Russians and the Chinese basically don't want any intervention anywhere, from what I can gather. You know, they didn't say anything about what happened in Libya. They weren't supportive of it, but they weren't non-supportive of it. But I think that the Russians are trying very much to not intervene in anything. If you look at what's happening to Putin at the moment, he's got his own fish to fry. I think that's the problem with Syria, is almost timing. Everybody else is now distracted with something else. The Americans are distracted with elections, Europeans are distracted by money, you know, Putin's distracted by corruption and various other things that he's up to, ballot rigging. So it's perhaps a timing thing. But the UN is very toothless.
Yes, Ian.
Nothing you've said surprises me. I was with Nasser in Egypt. It hasn't changed.
No.
The Minister for Planning, just as a little aside, said he thought he was going to fix it. He put electricity on everywhere and gave them television sets.
That helps with birth control.
It didn't.
No, well, but they don't have the right shows.
Can I switch you a little bit to Saudi Arabia? Mm-hmm. It seems to me it hasn't got much longer to go. What do you think?
Do you want to tell me why you think that?
Sorry?
Can you tell me why you think it doesn't have much longer to go?
Yeah, because it's an autocratic and, as you say, it's a corrupt monarchy.
Yep.
With some pretty odd people.
Yeah, inbreeding does that. No, it is.
It seems to me it could follow the pattern.
It could. Saudi Arabia's been a country that's been, I would say, on the brink for about 30 years.
That's right.
It's always on the brink, and it always seems to manage to hold it together. You know, they do have a very tight control on their population, and when things get really rough and it looks like the population's had enough, they kind of have this big, you know, outpouring of money to the people. And gestures of goodwill. And that kind of brings them, you know, buys them a little bit more time. And because they have oil and they have plenty of money to spread around. And they're very, very, I guess, restrictive on their population. But they appear benevolent. So where Gaddafi perhaps went wrong was that he appeared to be, you know, repressive, whereas they try and appear not to be repressive. You know, and I think the average Saudi is fairly cowed, you know. They don't want to sort of end up in a Saudi jail. So it's definitely a country on the brink, but who knows? They might outlast all of us.
Gentlemen,
thank you. I'm Robert Dolphin Institute. And the question that I had was about the Iranian influence on the actual Arab Spring, seeing the Iranians interfering in Bahrain, for example, having a lot of interest in Saudi Arabia and definitely in Syria. What strategy do they have, and what is the extent of what they want to see happen there?
Wow, okay. Well, I think the Iranians have an interest in seeing a destabilised Arab world. You know, there's a lot of competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and they certainly vie for influence in Bahrain. But again, Iran has its own problems. You know, its nuclear issue is something that bubbles along constantly. So they're balancing, I guess, looking at their own population and making sure that they're not, you know, encouraged by the uprisings elsewhere to, you know, and they've had protests after the last lot of elections in 2009. So it's a country that, you know, is not immune to sort of seeing the overflow themselves, so they're careful to buffet themselves from that. They've also got the ongoing issues with, you know, the border with Iraq and the sort of instability there flowing into their country. So I think what they're hoping for is to keep the region destabilised. They certainly don't want to see a powerful Saudi Arabia, but the other thing that they don't want to see is a crushed Arab world where Israel kind of dominates everything either. So they like all their enemies to be unstable.
Yes, it's the
Arabiani, I guess my affiliation is I was born in the Middle East, so
okay.
Can we just go back to the X? Because
don't worry, so do I, that's why I had to write it down. There we go.
I know that you're trying to fit the F theme, but I think the second one, football, I think what you're trying to say is pride.
Well, nationalism.
I would say pride.
Pride, okay.
It's not nationalism in the Middle East, it's more of an issue of pride. So when you see riots there, it's an upfront. And that's where things go very unstable very quickly. A lot of the fights that happen in these countries, and if you look at them, there's fights between families that have gone on for years and years, it's an issue of pride. So if you slice on an issue of pride, it doesn't matter how small it is, how big it is, that's when it escalates and it just goes completely out of control. And I'd say number seven is food. I'd say just food, because if you look at everything they've had to put up with for so many years, let it all explode. All of them are facing the same thing. If you look at their GDP and what's happened, they're getting better. I've looked at my family. When we moved from Lebanon, we were the only ones who were, went to foreign country. Few that had been educated. And then 10 years later, all my cousins, every single one of their families, there's someone who's overseas, someone who's getting an education, someone who's getting a master's. So they're getting better. And it's not just the Lebanon, it's all across the Middle East. But what's really triggered it, I think, is just the cost of living. And the biggest thing in Egypt was the cost of food. So to me, it's all to do with fertility and all that. Ultimately, it's linked. But I think that's what the seven is.
Okay.
Sorry. Could you ask your question,
yes,
please?
Yes, this is where I was going to get to.
Yes.
With foreign intervention, I think one thing that you didn't address fully, and I would really like to hear a little bit more about, is the intervention between the countries. We talk a lot about the West, but the biggest source of instability for all these countries is, you know, them interfering in each other's affairs. And I think the one that I really want you to talk about is Iran and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship with that section, because when you mentioned Libya and you said that there's oil, it's only 2% of the world's oil supply. You look at where Iran is.
Sorry, can you answer the question?
Yeah, I can answer the question. Look, the whole region is incredibly incestuous. Everybody's got a finger in somebody else's business. You know, that complicates matters. And I think the big issue is that nobody has a clear agenda necessarily. It's a region that they tend to play tactics rather than strategy. So they're like, okay, we want X now, so this is what we'll do. They don't think about their long-term goal for the future. So Iran, you know, has a lot of interest, I suppose, in a relationship with Syria. They have a lot of the same, I guess, goals in many respects. But that said, they don't agree on a lot of things. You know, there's that Persian-Arab divide as well. And, you know, they disagree on what's happening in Iraq. So the interaction between all of these countries is very difficult to understand, you know, and it's a three-way competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Israel for, you know, dominance over the entire region. You know, that's what that Iran nuclear issue is about. It's not whether or not they have nuclear weapons, because let's face it, they're never going to use them, but it's about power. That's all it is. They're vying for control and for power. And that's really what international politics is. And just on the 7, I plagiarised that, as I said, from Henry Precht. So, you know, as a good academic does.
Yeah. Angela and Pratt, my affiliation on this is obviously an important member of the Institute. Thank you again for a very insightful analysis of the Middle East and so passionately delivered.
Okay.
I guess one surprise to many is Algeria. Algeria's sort of reluctance there to roughly fairly early in the piece, I think it was from the heels of Tunisia.
Yep.
And while in the other countries where there were uprisings, you saw an outcome, bloody as in Libya or Syria, or very uncertain in Egypt. What surprised me is Algeria just seemed to be perfectly fizzled out. I was wondering, perhaps you can tell me the answer in the second framework, but why is there an Algeria fizzled out?
I think Algeria have experimented with democracy previously. And you, the elections in the 1990s that led to sort of their 10-year civil war left everyone pretty much exhausted. But that said, they had come out the other side with a functioning government. Corrupt, yes. Not one of the more corrupt, certainly not one of the more despotic. And I think that for the Algerians, they're aware of what happens when you protest and how easily it can descend into violence. And I think that the average Algerian didn't want to go there again. You know, 100,000 people died in their civil war. It was very, very bloody. And I think that that perhaps was a deterrent to people actually continuing on with the protests. You know, be careful what you wish for.
Michael,
tell me, council member. Turkey used to be friends with Syria 18 months ago. It seemed like they were very good friends. And then they were talking very belligerently early on in the thing. Then they seemed to have gone quiet. So where do they sit? I mean, they're a very important region. But aren't they one of the biggest armies there? Yeah.
They are.
And where do they sit vis-a-vis Syria, and also where do they sit vis-a-vis Iran?
Okay. Well, Turkey's very fickle, I suppose. And, you know, Turkey is dealing, as I said, with, I think, Iran as well, with its own problems. You know, the collapse of the EU is causing problems for Turkey because they've been trying so hard to get into it, and now, you know, all the economic relationships they've built with it are kind of causing them also grief. They've got their own problems with their military intervening in their government at the moment, so there's this power struggle within the Turkish government as well. They were looking more towards, I suppose, the Middle East, particularly in terms of what was happening in Gaza, you know, the Israeli blockade of Gaza and all that kind of stuff, which somewhat backfired on them. And I think that at the moment they're really looking at, you know, maintaining the stability of their own country. They don't want the events in Syria to spill over into their, so particularly the Kurdish population in the south, and cause problems for them. And so they're keeping their nose clean at the moment. They're condemning what's happening in Syria, but not enough that people will turn around and condemn them for doing the same thing. You know, and a lot of these governments, they're all pretty harsh. You know, the Turkish government isn't sweet and fuzzy. It might be a democracy, but it's, you know, very hard on some of its people. So I think they're just keeping their nose clean.
Yes, gentlemen in front.
I'm Marcus Wigan, student at Melbourne University. I'm interested in a critical point, that the resources required to leverage these countries from where they stand is both educational, skills transfer, and money. And money is almost an irreparable component. Unfortunately, the main source of this, of the money is foreign aid, which is increasingly conditional in this area. Can you see any positive direction in which such conditionality would be accepted?
Okay, I think you're right that education and financial support are probably the two things that will help these countries make progress. I think that the issue for a lot of the foreign aid at the moment is that it is conditional, that we don't want to see an Islamist government in control of our money. And also we have less money ourselves to give. You know, we've got our own problems. And so there is a balance between that. You know, most of these countries will accept foreign aid, tied or untied. They're at a point where they don't have much choice. But if there ever comes to a push between us funding an Islamist government and us, you know, saying, well, you know, you have to vote the right way, you know what we did with the Palestinians? You know, we took away their money and said, well, you voted badly. Wait till next time. You know, and I think we'll see that, you know, in the future, particularly if the Muslim Brotherhood. At the moment, they're very moderate and they're trying to work out the constitution and a power-sharing arrangement. But if you look what's happening in Iraq, you know, things do deteriorate.
Yes.
Malcolm McDonald, an independent member. I'm interested about self-determination and independence movements. You hear about Kurdistan, not much else. Is there anything else going on in the region?
Look, there's all kinds of little groups who fancy themselves as having, you know, an independent state. It's unlikely to happen. I mean, the Kurds are unlikely to get their own state. The best they're going to do is sort of an autonomous region in Iraq. You know, and the Iranian Kurds and the Syrian Kurds and the Turkish Kurds can forget about it. The Palestinians are probably the biggest movement who want their own state. And again, that's ground to a sort of a halt. You know, the two-state solution is, you know, well, not really viable in its current form. But there's other groups. There's Druze, there's Alawites, you know, there's Zoroastrians, there's Barbers. There's all kinds of groups who would like independence and autonomy, but it's unlikely to happen. Yeah? Does that answer your...
I was thinking Libya was another one that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, Libya is a region that's kind of fractured into three at this stage. There's three distinct sort of Libyan tribes, I suppose, if you want to call them that, Libyan groupings, but unlikely to fracture into independent states. You know, the National Transitional Council is busy, you know, consolidating their power base for all of Libya.
Yes, off the back there.
Libya is a bit of an outlier as far as Gaddafi was always hated and distrusted even by other leaders in Africa and the Middle East, so they were more than happy to see him go for his asylum rather than establishment more. And also, Britain, especially after what happened in the United States, had a personal vendetta against Gaddafi more than they would have against Assad. So I think that we would agree that it's probably Libya is a difficult thing to draw examples from because of the historical situation.
I've always thought Libya was special. I will agree with you there. I think, given that I had half an hour to talk, I simplified everything massively. I could, you know, prattle on about this for like days and days, and you wouldn't be able to shut me up. So yes, I agree. I would say that the European debt crisis is really only flowing into the region more and more at the moment. So the you know, the effects are being felt more widely than they were originally. And a lot of that's tourism. You know, tourism has just dried up right across the region. And that's, you know, where Europeans would easily go to holiday. You know, and they're not doing that at the moment. You know, and not only that, but it's the feeling that there's, you know, a lack of money that's also causing sort of further, I guess, spending cutbacks. But you're right. Look, it's an ongoing problem and has been the same for a very long time.
And the lady in the green dress, you had your...
I'm Shaibon, a very new member of Access. I was just wondering, you're very cynical, it seems, about the whole thing. It seems like, despite getting rid of all these autocrats and all these leaders, that they're still going to have elite powers that have other than bad intentions, I guess. Is there absolutely no chance that the will of the population can come and turn around and have an influence on democracy or social change that might actually improve the lives of people in the Arab world?
I am probably cynical. I hope I'm not. But I think that, look, anything's possible. We could see democracy, you know, bring about peace and happiness and full tummies, but not in the short term. I think that there's a lot of short-term pain before there's any long-term gain from what we're seeing now. And I think that the people who are paying the price at the moment for, I guess, that transition aren't going to be the ones who reap the benefits in the future. You know, the issues, particularly the population issues, but the economic issues and everything that flows on from that, education, health, housing, all those things, infrastructure, they don't come, you know, in the next 5 years or the next 10 years. We're looking at long-term sort of projects. But it doesn't mean it won't happen. You know, it won't happen overnight, but it will happen.
Okay, last question. Yes.
Would you be good enough to give us your take on Morocco and Jordan?
Sure. They're very lucky, because particularly the leadership, because they're kings, they're monarchs, they have that kind of hereditary legitimacy. I think Jordan, the king, is very popular. You know, he's very popular with the people, and so he's not being blamed for any of the problems that are going on. They're blaming sort of, you know, the ministers and the government sort of in that direction. The same for Morocco. You know, the king is trying, but he's giving limited reforms. But he's popular, and I think that's the difference. They're not brutal dictators. They're inherited power from their fathers, and their fathers were popular. And so there's that kind of, I suppose, feeling from the population that the king is good, and yes, there are some bad things going on, but it's really not his fault. And so it gives them the stability to sort of, I guess, hold on. They are trying to make limited reforms, but they are limited. But they're countries that don't have the same, you know, problems that a lot of the corruption that has been brought about in the autocratic countries.
Is their birth rate as high as the other countries?
It's high, but it's not as high. But again, they've got smaller population. The problem for Jordan is all the Palestinian refugees. And the Iraqi refugees, and now the Syrian refugees. So the huge refugee population is causing a strain on their economy. And, you know, it's a country that when I visited in 2006, and I visited again last year, I noticed a decline, I would say, in, you know, the quality of the roads and sort of just the general sort of decay of the state.
Thank you. Well, I thought that was really stimulating, really interesting, and it's given us all, I suppose most of us had a sense that the Middle East was incredibly complex, and it's still incredibly complex. I don't think it's fair. You might be happy to wear the mantle of a cynic, but I don't think it's, you have to. I think the complexities of the Middle East are such that it's easy to see the problems, and it's not so easy to see the solutions. But you've helped us to identify the problems more. You may have pointed some of us in the direction of solutions. I hope you have. But it's certainly been a really interesting talk, Sally, and I think, as you said, you could have, in your words, prattled on for hours. I think we might take you up on that and have you to come along and talk a little bit more about some of the components of the Middle East, because we've had this overview today, but there are really there are other ways of looking at this, looking at it through the prisms of individual countries, and I think if you're willing, we're certainly willing. And
I'll do anything for a glass of wine.
Good. Well, that's the next thing. I was going to ask you whether you've taken a pledge since you were here last, because if you'll just wait 1 minute, I'll find a bottle of wine. So can I, before calling the meeting to a close, remind you of some upcoming talks, which I hope will attract many of you. Wednesday the 8th of February, Michael Angwin of the Australian Uranium Association is to talk on exporting uranium, the economic and diplomatic case. Thursday 16th of February, and that's a Thursday, not a Wednesday, Ian Harper of Deloitte Access Economics will talk about challenges for the global economy, and God knows there are a lot of them. And if you think you're cynical with Miss Sally cynical about the Middle East, once you get economists talking about the global economy. And on Wednesday the 22nd, more on the global economy with Professor Pasquale Sgro of Deakin University, who's just back from Italy, talking about Italy, crisis and contagion. So there you are. Thank you very much.